Americans are getting ready to celebrate the 4th, and some of our neighbors to the north are also marking a major birthday in July. Thursday is the 400th anniversary of Quebec City, one of the oldest cities in North America. To join the party, we brought in our own Breath of Wind from the north.
Oh, Rosette, petite Rosette, y'a ben longtemps que je t'ai pas vue.
This band that you're hearing is called, literally, Wind from the North, or Le Vent du Nord in French. And two of its members have joined us from our studios of the CBC in Montreal. Good morning. Bonjour, I should say, I suppose.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Would you please introduce yourselves?
I am Nicolas Boulris, and I play accordion, piano, I sing, and I also play the hurdy-gurdy.
I'm Olivier Demers. In the band, I play violin. And I do also the foot tapping.
We'll hear more about those feet in a minute. For now, let's just say that because this music is of Quebec, it's a mix of everything and everyone who ever lived or landed in that province. You have French lyrics, Celtic tunes, an Irish jig or two, even the music of Native Americans. Band members Nicolas Boulris and Olivier Demers say these songs are like antiques, and they collect them.
We do try to preserve the repertoire who is not already picked or recorded.
Yeah, a lot of people, it's Nicolas talking, a lot of people told us we were like a gardien de la tradition.
Guardians of the tradition.
Yes, a little bit.
Something like that. The old people want to know if you're respectful, you know, if you sing those songs in the way of the tradition.
This is the magic of it. We want to keep the real soul of the fiddle tune with that little crooked part or that little out-of-tune way typically from Quebec to play it.
Give us an example of one of those rare songs that you collected from, an older person and that you treated with the respect that it was due.
We met a guy in Saint-Guillaume. It's a village like 45 minutes out of Montreal. I don't remember why we heard about that guy. I think the mayor of the village, he said, oh yeah, we have a very good singer in the village. And we said, why not? So we just knocked at his door and we said, hello, we are musicians. We love music. And we started drinking and singing with him. And he had a wonderful voice. And he sang many kind of beautiful songs. And one of them, it's La Beauté du Mariage, The Beauty of the Wedding. It goes a little bit like that. C'est, quand on y parle du mariage, oui, c'est un joli passe-temps.
Quand on y parle du mariage, oui, c'est un joli passe-temps.
Oui, c'est un joli passe-temps, je n'oserais le dire.
Car si ma tendre m'y partait, je souffrirais le martyr.
Olivier Demers, I heard your feet on a board.
Yes, exactly.
And
it's the traditional percussion in Quebec. Because in the kitchen parties in the big family, because of our Catholic ancestor, we had like 15, 20 children in the same family.
Per room.
So the Saturday night evening was very important. Probably there was one fiddle player and the fiddler had to do the foot tapping to make them dance all in the same beat. We can dance on very crooked tunes like 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4.
There's one song on the CD. It's La Fille et les Dragons.
Yeah.
La Fille et les Dragons.
And,
exactly.
And I'm curious about it on a number of levels. One is what it says. It's a little story, which is sort of strange and dreamlike.
Si vous en tournez en France, vous ferez mes compliments.
Tournez en France, vous ferez
mes compliments à tous mes parents et à ma sœur Angélique.
You know, the dragon, we're talking about the woman and the dragon, if we translate La Fille et le Dragon, it's, they are the knights.
Like dragoons. Maybe, yes.
In fact, the young lady decide to stay with those soldiers. She just said, you know, that guy just
brushed my hair,
the other one cleaned my house, and I'm just sitting on the knee of
the third one. So I'm very happy. I don't want to go back home.
One thing about the song is it goes from this sort of ancient dream-like space to a sort of modern feel.
It's our kind of scat. We call that turlute. It's also to imitate the flute was very, very popular instrument. And in French, when you learn flute, you have to do tu-tu-tu-tu-tu-tu-tu with the mouth. So it became sur le tu ta di ta di pa di ta di ti da. So it's a way to fake, because we didn't have a lot of musicians, but we have a lot of singers.
Yeah, it's also a way to express joy without anything. You know, the life was very hard here for to cut the trees and to try to survive, and it's quite north, so as you imagine, the winters, especially this winter, was like 6 meters and a half of snow. But at the time, you know, with not that much heat, and it was hard life, but without any fiddle, without anything, they got together to make this beautiful place called Quebec now.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Ah, pleasure. Merci.
Thanks for inviting us.
Olivier Demers and Nicolas Boulouris, two members of the four-person band from Quebec, Le Vent de Nord. This weekend, while folks here in the States celebrate the 4th of July, our friends to the north mark the 400th anniversary of Quebec City. Later, this band will be heading our way, too.
Le Vent de Nord will be in USA and plenty of festivals this summer, so come to hear us and come dancing with us.
A bientôt.
A bientôt.
A bientôt.
Ben, les bagues que je te donne pas ne te feront jamais mal aux doigts. Ben, les bagues que je te donne pas ne te feront jamais mal aux doigts. Je donnerai à une autre qui sera de mon goût. Et toi, petite rosette, tu seras oubliée.
Hear more songs from Le Vent de Nord? Please look for the music section at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Cholesterol drugs are some of the hottest pharmaceutical products on the market. But a new study takes a look at what happens when people try what some consider a more natural approach, a dietary supplement called red rice yeast. The study is published today in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the results come with one major caveat.
Barry Barron is a 59-year-old engineer who lives in the suburbs of Philadelphia. These days, he's trying to eat right, walk the cul-de-sac with his wife in the evenings, and to keep his cholesterol in check, he's taking capsules of red rice yeast. His whole wellness program began as a fluke a few years ago when he learned from his doctor that his blood pressure and cholesterol were way too high. At first, he was dismissive.
And I sort of put it in the back of my mind and said, you know, it's really not that big of a deal.
But then he met a cardiologist named David Becker, who runs a program called Change of Heart. Becker was looking for patients, like Barron, who were at risk of having heart attacks or strokes, to participate in a 12-week experiment.
The key point is to get people to try to make lifestyle changes.
Becker also wanted to compare what happens to cholesterol levels when you add a standard cholesterol-lowering drug, such as the statin Zocor, versus the dietary supplement red rice yeast. Becker said he'd been hearing anecdotes for years that red rice yeast works. In fact, the original statin drugs were derived from a similar yeast. To test this, he put about 35 patients on Zocor and 35 others on red rice yeast.
And after 12 weeks, the results were virtually indistinguishable.
Meaning patients in both groups significantly reduced their cholesterol levels, especially the bad type of cholesterol called low-density lipoproteins.
The LDL went down in both groups about 40%.
Becker says he can't say for certain how much the diet and exercise were responsible for the improvements, but he has noticed that red rice yeast doesn't seem to produce the muscle cramping that is sometimes a side effect of statin drugs.
If you're very anxious to avoid cholesterol medications, or if you've had side effects from those medications, then this might be an alternative.
Becker says he would never take certain patients off statin drugs. This includes people who have advanced heart disease, meaning they've already had a heart attack, angioplasty, or stents. For them, statin medications can be life-saving. But for people such as 59-year-old Barry Barron, who had only high cholesterol but no other signs of illness, the combination of lifestyle changes and supplements seems to be working well.
I just had a stress test done, and went with flying colors, actually improved my health.
Barron says he knows he's got to have the discipline to keep up the exercise and diet. That's in his control. But here's the caution with red rice yeast. The capsules used during the study were tested and certified for their potency and purity. But cardiologist David Becker says that's not necessarily the case for all bottles of red rice yeast that you'll find on drugstore shelves.
You just don't know what you're getting. And you can get a batch one time, which is perfect and lowers your cholesterol, and then you can get another batch from the same company that might not be as good because nothing's regulated.
A new analysis out today from the supplement testing company ConsumerLab.com confirms this point. ConsumerLab's Todd Cooperman says he tested 10 brands of red rice yeast and found shocking differences in concentrations of the main active ingredient called lovastatin.
We found a 100-fold difference. One product had over 10 milligrams of lovastatin per pill. Another one had less than 0.1 milligrams of lovastatin.
Another finding is that 4 of the 10 brands were contaminated with a substance called citrinin, which is known to be toxic to the kidneys. All of this information puts consumers in a tough spot. The results of red rice yeast are promising, but as with all unregulated supplements, problems with quality control and contamination undermine confidence. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
One of the ways that California tries to prevent fires is by keeping an eye on wilderness areas. The state's fire watchers look out for things like bolts of lightning, smoldering trees. KQED's Sasha Coca recently visited a fire watch tower in central California. It's about 8,000 feet high with terrifying drop-offs on either side.
It's a two-mile hike up switchbacks and a climb up 188 wooden stairs to get to Margie Kelly's fire tower in Giant Sequoia National Monument. But Kelly, a 55-year-old grandmother, is tough enough to do it with a mountain bike.
Isn't it great? I love it.
She's lean and blonde and constantly wears polarized sunglasses to help her spot smoke. In the Needles Fire Tower, she's braved earthquakes, lightning strikes, and sometimes 80 fires in a season. The view through her tower windows is breathtaking. Kelly can scan a 360-degree panorama that includes Mount Whitney and the Tehachapi Mountains north of Los Angeles.
Trees. Oh, here comes my weather.
For the North Sequoia National Forest, high pressure over the region will keep very warm and dry conditions across the district through at least Friday.
Kelly lives 6 months a year in this tidy 14 by 14 foot room. A plush double bed takes up a third of the space, and then there's a tiny stove and oven, a propane refrigerator, and a water crock for drinking and washing. A helicopter flies in periodically to bring supplies and empty out the porta potty. Her radio console dominates the center of the room. On this day, as 23-mile-an-hour winds start to pick up and rattle the windows, another lookout calls in a report of a fire near a campground.
Yeah. Fire, fire, fire. That's what that means. Three tones is fire.
All units, Fort Bill. Report of a vegetation fire response area in Lake.
Kelly spends most of her time listening to radio traffic, peering through binoculars, and plotting fires on a huge circular map covered by a glass disc.
It's hard to see what a fire is doing when you're on the ground and it's right in front of you. So they rely on us to give them the big picture. You know, and if they're in a helicopter, they've got the big picture. But flight time's expensive. They're only in the air when they have to be.
This is Kelly's 21st season up in this tiny tower. She has no cell phone, no electricity, but she says she's never lonely.
I don't understand the concept. I would think that a person that's lonely has a complete lack of imagination. And I don't. I can entertain myself. Hello, refrigerator.
What do you want to eat today, Morgan?
I don't know. What would you like to feed me?
Some days she'll see no one but a few peregrine falcons.
He was flying around checking me out. They're like, what are you? What are you doing there? Are you a bird? Yeah, is that your nest? Cool nest.
And then there are the visitors. She bakes chocolate chip cookies for the rock climbers who come to scale the famous pinnacles next to the tower. Her grandkids come and stay for a week each year, and about 1,000 tourists hike up each season to see her. Some of these tourists make her nervous when they press their noses to the glass and watch her cook her lunch.
The monkey behind the glass. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Watch her eat. People are so unaware that you can live like this, that I'll actually get asked, what do you eat? And I'll say, dirt and needles.
But Kelly doesn't mind answering most questions from visitors.
I had a little girl ask me once, wasn't I afraid out here? I can't think of anything that makes me afraid other than people. They can get pretty weird, but I said, are you afraid? She said, well, yeah, we just had a drive-by shooting. And I said, honey, I guarantee you I've never had a drive-by shooting.
What she does worry about, though, are lightning strikes. She spends most of her day perched atop a lightning stool, a wooden platform with glass feet that helps deflect electric current.
Once I see a storm now, I get on the stool, ever since the antenna was vaporized, because it's important we don't get fried.
Kelly knows her unique job may not be around forever. In the 1930s, there were an estimated 9,000 active fire lookouts nationwide. Now there are less than 1,000. And as fire managers face tough budget choices, there's talk of installing cameras to watch fires instead. But Margie Kelly believes there's no substitute for the human eye. For NPR News, I'm Sasha Coca.
If you would like to see what the view looks like from that fire tower, go to our website. It's npr.org.
It's only Tuesday, but the week's already half over for city employees in Birmingham, Alabama. As of today, city employees only have to work a four-day week, although they do have to work 10 hours on each of those days. Birmingham is just the latest city to go to the four-day week to deal with higher fuel prices. This summer, government employees in the state of Utah will stay home on Fridays. Lawmakers in states including Arkansas, New Mexico, and Idaho are considering doing it as well. To find out more, we turn to Chris Hartzell. He's chief of operations for the city of Birmingham, and he's helping implement the new plan. It sounds like the city is hoping to save employees gas, but also much more key for the city is to save the energy that it needs to run things.
Absolutely. I think you got two benefits there. You know, the employees specifically will receive a benefit by not having the expense of driving to work one day a week. And then the city will receive it some because, you know, a lot of the employees that work with the city use city vehicles. You know, some of that will be cut down by this. You know, while it's a four-day work week for the employees, the city will still be in operation 5 days a week. We are just breaking the shifts up between Friday and Mondays because we want to allow the citizens that have to do business with the city to still have access to the city.
Now, let's get down, though, to what the city hopes to save. I gather that the city's paying about 50% more for gas than it did a year ago. And the city doesn't pay tax on gas, does it?
No, it's certainly lower than, you know, you or I would pay just to go fill up our car at the local gas station. But it has gone up by 50%. You are correct.
But, you know, give us some examples of what kinds of savings you would hope to get out of making this switch.
The city specifically will receive, you know, the energy savings. I said there will be less vehicles driven because of this initiative. The biggest benefit will be received by the employees. And we have already implemented this with our public works department about 2 months ago, and it's worked extremely well there. The morale's there. You know, we've received some feedback from citizens about we need people to work harder, not less.
The four-day work week, or at least alternative four-day work weeks, have been experimented with here in Southern California, where I am, for, well, since the early 90s. And what they discovered is that workers actually didn't drive less. They just drove other places on
right.
that day off.
And that's certainly been a question that we've fielded, and that's something that we have to monitor. The average commute was about 20 miles for the employees that work for the city coming into work. And if we could relieve that one day a week, we thought would be a benefit to the city and to the employees.
And again, how would it be a benefit to the city? Let's say an inspector is out there. What, a building inspector? out there driving around. Now he drives around 5 days a week, but you're going to ask him to work 40 hours, but it'll only be in 4 days. Won't he drive around just as much?
Well, I've heard that as well, but if you're adding the number of employees on that particular day that are not going to be driving, if you're cutting it in half between Friday and Monday, we project it will be less. Every inspector might not be out 10 hours. I mean, we're not going to have them out in the field necessarily, and we're probably talking about bringing them back in.
Well, is there anything at all scientific about the savings here, or is it a way to make your workers feel better?
I think the efficiencies that the city can pick up, the morale that it does for the employees, all that goes towards better city government.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
I really appreciate it. Anytime.
Chris Hartzell is Chief of Operations for the City of Birmingham, Alabama.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Before Freddy Krueger, Jason, or Hannibal Lecter, there was Norman Bates. In Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 classic film Psycho, Bates was the boy next door, motel manager slash serial killer, with the emphasis there on slash, a quiet guy who mummified his mother. NPR's Peter Breslow has the latest for our series In Character on what made Norman Bates so terrifying.
Let's just get this out of the way immediately, shall we? There you have it, the scene that ruined showering for a generation. Norman Bates, dressed as his mother, pulling back the curtain and slashing Marion Crane in room number one at the Bates Motel, just a third of the way into the film. Conductor Bernard Herrmann provided the strings. The sound of the stabbing came courtesy of a knife plunged into a cassava melon. Psycho was made fast and cheap, and it scared the pants off audiences in 1960. The inspiration for Norman Bates goes back a few years earlier, according to Stephen Rebello. He's the author of Alfred Hitchcock and The Making of Psycho. He says that in November 1957, authorities in rural Plainfield, Wisconsin, were looking for a woman who had gone missing. Following a clue, they entered the darkened farmhouse of a seemingly harmless 51-year-old handyman named Ed Gein.
They found this particular woman, unfortunately tortured and dressed out like a steer, hanging from her ankles. She'd been gutted, and the house was a kind of a charnel house of decomposing body parts, skull heads lined up on shelves.
Living just 40 miles away was a well-respected suspense writer named Robert Bloch, who read about Gein in the newspapers and became fascinated. He decided to fictionalize Gein's story, and his novel, Psycho, was published 2 years later. It tells the story of a schizophrenic man who, years after his father dies, has murdered his demanding and controlling mother and her lover. And he continues to murder, not as himself, but as his mother. Hitchcock read a review of the book and was hooked. After he acquired the rights to Psycho, he eventually turned to a young screenwriter named Joseph Stefano. It didn't hurt that Stefano himself was in Freudian analysis at the time. But there was a problem. The screenwriter didn't like how the novelist had portrayed Norman in his book, a middle-aged, pudgy mama's boy obsessed with Nazis.
But Hitchcock floored him. He said, "Well, don't worry about that, dear boy. How would you feel if Norman were played by Anthony Perkins?" Well, that was a whole other world. Perkins was in his late 20s, you know, good-looking, elfin, strange. You know, he was groomed as the new James Dean, and that excited Stefano immediately. And he sort of looked at Hitchcock and said, "Oh, now we're talking."
Making the killer appealing is the key to the film, says Rebello, especially after Hitchcock confoundedly kills off his star, Janet Leigh as Marion Crane, so early in the movie. Perkins was a bit of a teen heartthrob at the time, but he also had experience playing intense characters, including a baseball player who has a mental breakdown in the film Fear Strikes Out. We see this nervous energy early on in Psycho when Norman prepares an awkward dinner at the motel for soon-to-be-dispatched Marion.
You eat like a bird.
You know, of course.
No, not really. Anyway, I hear the expression "eats like a bird" is really a falsity, because birds really eat a tremendous lot. But I don't really know anything about birds. My hobby is stuffing things. You know, taxidermy.
Norman stammers and stutters were Tony Perkins' idea. So was having Norman pop pieces of candy corn in his mouth when he gets nervous. Obviously, Perkins had stepped into the role of his life.
It's a weird coincidence that Stefano knew nothing about Tony Perkins' life, and yet he wrote that Norman Bates had lost his father at 5, had a very domineering mother, and that's exactly what happened to Tony Perkins.
And there was at least one other confluence that made Perkins perfect for the part, says Ronald Bergen, author of Anthony Perkins, A Haunted Life. Both men had hidden lives they wanted to keep secret, Norman's as a serial killer and Perkins as a gay man in the 1950s.
And I think that fear of being discovered was a terrible fear for Tony Perkins. Not only did he think that Norman Bates would destroy his career, but obviously if he was exposed as a gay man. And his life ended with the headlines in the papers saying, Norman Bates dies of AIDS.
Perkins never did shake Norman. By the time he died in 1992, he had appeared in 3 unremarkable sequels to Psycho. But why can't we shake Norman Bates either?
Well, if anyone gets any answers, it'll be the psychiatrist.
Dr. Justin Frank has a few notions. He's a psychiatrist who lectures on film. And he wouldn't mind getting Norman Bates on his couch, as long as it was in a well-guarded institution.
I would probably work with his hatred of his mother and his rage at being abandoned. And then I would work very intensively with how every single session, at the end of each session, he would probably feel like killing me because he can't stand to have anybody turn their back on him.
The psychiatrist in the movie continues the analysis of Norman's split personality.
I got the whole story. But not from Norman. I got it from his mother. Norman Bates no longer exists. He only half existed to begin with. And now, the other half has taken over. Probably for all time.
He's an interesting guy who essentially substitutes the pain of loss and grieving with becoming the other person. So one way to manage loss is you totally take on the characteristics and the behavior of the person who's dead. But I think that if you got him on an analytic couch, you would begin to see breakthroughs between those two partial people. I don't think he's irretrievably lost the way it was presented.
Critics point to Norman Bates' legacy in brainy, charming, psychotic killers like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, someone we'd maybe like to hang out with, except for the killing part. But it's just that killing part, says Justin Frank, that makes us love Norman Bates, at least up there on the movie screen.
People are excited by people who don't just yell, kill the umpire, but actually do kill the umpire. And I think there's something about that that makes him enduring also.
And for any holdouts in the audience, there's Alfred Hitchcock's final brilliant scene. Norman, his personality now completely overtaken by his mother, sitting alone, locked in a room at the county courthouse.
They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Peter Breslow, NPR News.
Watch classic creepy moments from Psycho and join the conversation on our in-character blog at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
America has a long tradition of traveling musicians. Artists of all types hit the road to play in dead-end bars and dimly lit basements, often for little more than gas money. Nowadays, gas money wouldn't be a bad night's pay, except fewer bands can afford to go on tour. Charles Michael Ray of South Dakota Public Broadcasting reports on what that might mean for your local aspiring rock star.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Jay Whalen Porcupine just dropped $50 in gas into a 1995 Chevy van.
$50 gives you 13 gallons, and it's kind of sad because this is a 30-gallon tank.
Porcupine is the frontman for the band The Redmen. In the last 2 years, the three-piece band from Rapid City, South Dakota, has driven about 30,000 miles in this van, hitting small towns and big cities across the country to play a unique version of pop punk, including this fast and loud piece titled This Year's Mono. This song isn't about high gas prices, but after spending $50 on less than half a tank, Porcupine can't help but to look back at the way things were, when a band like his could afford to take its act on the road. He remembers when they could get paid $50 or $100 at a small show and have enough money to make it to the next town.
This kind of lifestyle, this way of life, just might go extinct because of the gas prices, really. Just, you know, we haven't toured in a couple months, and it's just, we've been really just rethinking the game plan.
A lot of musicians are rethinking their plans. One of them is Minneapolis-based Haley Bonner. The 24-year-old artist is about to release her fourth CD. The title track, Big Star, seems to lament the desire to reach for fame. To promote her CD, Bonner is planning a cross-country tour this summer. Even with new forms of internet marketing, she says going on tour makes a big difference.
It's a good thing to be in those cities as that's happening because, you know, people are hearing your music, hearing your name, reading about you and whatever. It's really the best time to go and do that.
For her upcoming tour, Bonner is budgeting $2,000 just for gas. She says if gas prices continue to go up, she won't be able to afford to tour anymore. The price at the pump has forced some musicians to cancel their tour plans altogether. Others are finding alternative ways to travel.
I'm touring on a canoe from Buffalo to New York City.
Right now, Christopher Bell is touring in California in his 97 Toyota Corolla. But in mid-July, he'll trade his car for a canoe and head down the Erie Canal, hoping to stop and play some of the towns along the route.
I have never done an actual long canoe trip, so I'm planning 20 miles a day, which I've been told by another guy who's canoed the whole Erie Canal that should be fine.
Bell follows in the footsteps of troubadours like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, the kind of musicians who are driven more by the love of music than by fame or money. Bell is optimistic that high gas prices won't kill off touring musicians.
I think it would be a sad day if it did. People will find a way, and music will get out. People will still see shows.
If you live along the Erie Canal, keep an eye out for Christopher Bell this summer. Maybe he'll play you the song called Oh, How We Danced, if that is, his arms aren't too tired from paddling.
Everyone here, it seems, is lost from all the dreams, and all I want is for you to come back to me.
For NPR News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Last week.